Welcome back to the AgTech So What podcast, brought to you by AgThentic. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. If you've been listening with us for a while, you'll have noticed that we removed the intro. I'd been wanting to update or get rid of this for a while, but some recent listener feedback gave me the push I needed to make it happen. So thanks, Bernie, and goodbye to long intro. Today's episode is rebroadcast from 2017, when I spoke with Allison Koff, CEO and founder of AgriList. AgriList is an American ag tech company that has built what they call a cultivation management platform to help indoor farmers and specialty croppers. Since we recorded this, Allison has been named to the Forbes 30 Under 30, and AgriList, her company, has actually rebranded so that it's now called Artemis. More info on both of these are in the show notes. The episode is largely the same, though we've added a bit of polish. That said, the audio quality is not amazing. We used to struggle with this, that longtime listeners know. So sorry about that, but we did want to bring you this for a few reasons. First, indoor ag is still an exciting space, and Allison's insights are great. And second, at the end, Allison and I cover some ground that's really relevant for International Women's Day, even though we're a week late. Anyways, that's enough for me. We start the episode with Allison, who has a degree in physics and did not grow up on a farm, explaining how she got into agriculture.
I started working for a greenhouse company back in 2011 that was trying to solve a lot of challenges in terms of the actual production side by building greenhouses closer to the point of consumption and growing more sustainably for the local population. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with the ag industry. I fell in love with growers. The idea of growing food to me was incredibly beautiful. It's something that we all eat, but we don't all actually get to touch the system at play. And just getting really close to it was something I just fell in love with. And so I knew that this was a place for me.
This love for agriculture led Allison to start an ag tech company.
The whole problem that I'm trying to solve at AgriList is it all originated there. It all originated when you're doing the farming, the duties of farming every day, right? So you're trying to make ends meet. You have low margins. You're trying to understand where you're selling and who you're selling to. And that to me is a data problem, which is the problem we're trying to solve at AgriList, which is you build software that can make all of those data problems, not problems, but instead benefits to the grower. So how can you increase the margin by looking at all the information at your hand? And trying to use that to complete the picture and really focus on that margin side.
I love that story coming in from non-ag. That's been my journey as well, sort of coming more from the tech engineering side. How has that been working in the ag industry without a kind of ag background?
Yeah, you know, the funniest thing about that is, so whenever you talk to somebody who's in the ag industry but is in conventional ag, right, so any of the conventional agriculture fields, they'll tell me that I don't have a background in ag, and anybody in our space, in the environment space specifically, I've got one of the longest backgrounds in ag, which is this very interesting, nuanced problem that exists in the industry. So I've worked on the operations side of controlled environment ag for the better part of a decade now, and probably there's only about three or four companies that have been around in the fast growth, venture-backed controlled environment space in that period. So there aren't that many of us in this group that have done that. And there's not that many of us that have a tech background as well, where we can combine those two pieces of information to actually create this interesting solution for the space. And so, no, I didn't grow up on a farm. My parents weren't farmers, but I actually have been one of the few people to have worked in the industry as long as I have, at least in this specific industry, right? Now, that's not to say that it's the entire industry as a whole. One of the challenges that you do face, or at least I face, is I know how most of these facilities operate, but the greenhouse industry as a whole has been around for decades and decades and decades, and it is more conventional. And so that's a space that there is this sort of outsider feel. But I think that there's a big trust element. I think ag in general is based off of an element of trust. A lot of sales happen via, I trust that this person can solve this problem for me, and I trust the product or service that they provide. And, you know, when I go in the facility and I can speak the speak because I actually understand it and there's a curiosity there, then the growers end up tending to build that trust innately. So that's a roundabout answer.
No, but a good one. And that's been my experience too, that despite sometimes being an outsider, coming in with curiosity and willingness to learn, then people want to teach you and want to show you what they're passionate about and what they've been doing. Yeah. You mentioned that green offices are different, or that that's one kind of flavor of indoor ag, and there are different ones. I would love to get the kind of indoor farming 101 section from you for those who aren't as familiar with the different types of systems.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we think about the industry, at least, and I know that this isn't necessarily standardized yet for the way that most people think about the space, is that there is really two different types of systems at play here. There is a fully enclosed indoor system where you're not relying on sunlight at all, and then a hybrid system where you do have sunlight, but you might also have supplemental light in your building in a greenhouse where there's access to natural light. Now, there's a whole different spectrum of types of growing systems that could fit within those two pictures. You can have hydroponics where you're submerging the roots of a plant into water. You can have aquaculture or aquaponics where there's fish involved in the process as well, and you're using the fish, you know, the fish process to actually fertilize the plants, and there's a whole filtration system there at play. You can have aeroponics where you're misting the roots of the crops with a nutrient solution. So, and you can have soil, right? You can have conventional soil as well. So there's this sort of full spectrum of different types of growing systems. But the way that we think about it typically is that there's either no sunlight or sunlight involved in the picture. And one of the interesting things as a market is that they're pretty segmented as well. The vertical farming or fully enclosed farming has only really been around for the last few years in it, and it's really in its infancy. There's been people who have tried it for a long time, but in the last few years, it started to gain a lot of momentum because people are starting to figure out the unit economics, the cost of LEDs is going down, and you happen to have a lot of things in your favor related to the macro challenges of efficiencies, but also food safety and the challenges around pathogens in our crops specifically, so things like leafy greens and herbs. And so that space is starting to take off. And then you've got the greenhouse industry, which I would also categorize into two different spaces, which is you've got the greenhouse industry of old. So you've got your Almeria, Spain. You've got most of rural China where greenhouses are present. You've got sort of low-tech plastic facilities that serve for low, you know, low-margin, high-efficiency, fast distribution and broad distribution crops. And then you've got this high-tech, maybe more automated, intelligent-driven glass greenhouses, the facilities of the Netherlands and now the U.S. and Canada that are really quickly taking off because, again, of those challenges in the system of efficiencies and supply and food safety and just the ability to get a higher margin than in conventional applications for certain crops.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned the certain crop distinction because there's a obviously a conversation around the world about feeding the growing population and healthier food and the kind of macro trends, some of which you mentioned. What's your view on indoor agriculture's ability to feed that growing population and what role do you see it playing? Like, are we sort of going to move to a much more fully indoor system and can you grow everything indoors or where are the lines and maybe barriers in that sense?
Yeah, indoor ag is a tool in the agricultural toolkit is how I would phrase it. You can only grow certain crops indoors, and I would say ever, actually. I wouldn't even say that that's a now thing. I would say now we've got a small group of things you can grow indoors, and I'd say in the future, you know, 10 years out, 20 years out, you can probably increase that spectrum, but you're never going to do certain crops indoors because it doesn't make sense economically, and at the end of the day, ag is about economics more than almost anything. And so if you think about things that you can grow really well indoors, take a vertical farm as an example. So you've got a fully enclosed warehouse and you're trying to grow things in racks. And the reason for that is you're trying to optimize your square footage, your growable area, right? Your square footage of growable area. So if I'm going to stack things, well, the things that I can grow there by nature have to be physically short. You can't grow vine crops there because you're trying to stack. So the more stacking ability you have, the better off you're going to be. So that's limiting you off the bat to certain crops that are physically short crops. You need shorter growth cycle crops because the more turns you can have, the more you can generate from an economic perspective. So now you're looking at a bucket of things like leafy greens and lettuces. You're looking at herbs. You're looking at strawberries and certain berries. So you're limited to this sort of pool of crops that you can grow. And then you need to look at the unit economics. It's expensive to operate an indoor facility because you're running things like lighting almost 24/7, right? And so if you take a picture of economics, now you're looking at high margin items. So now you're still stuck in this bucket of herbs, lettuces, and potentially the berries and strawberries, you know, specifically strawberries. So that's a small pool. If you look at things like corn, wheat, soy, you know, those are commodity crops. They're really cheap to produce. You can do it en masse, and you can do it pretty well outdoors. So there's no real reason to bring that production indoors. And at the same time, I'd say there's no real reason to look at lettuce production in Salinas and say that that's the correct way to do it. So I think what you'll see is you'll start to see crops that can be grown to the quality and cost of conventional or better start to move indoors if it makes sense to do that. And then greenhouses can grow pretty much anything. It's just about economics at this point, because you can have a soil, you can have soil production and grow corn in a greenhouse. It doesn't make economic sense to do that, so you probably wouldn't do that. But if you can find a crop that works economically within these facilities, and you can do that sustainably, economically, and meet the quality, I think, and safely, actually, and if you can meet the food safety demands, I'd say there's probably no reason to grow that anywhere but indoors. So I think it'll be a piece of the puzzle. I'm not a believer that it's the end all be all. I don't know that there is one in our agricultural system.
I'm curious too about the kind of types of farmers, because one of the arguments that I've heard made for the growth of indoor farming is sort of anyone can be a farmer, and you can farm in a city, or you can supplement more conventional farming with an indoor system. And so it broadens not only the type of crops and the margin and economics that you can get, but also who is a farmer and who will be a farmer in the future. What's your view, or like what evidence do you have so far of who are the farmers of the future, especially in the indoor space?
That's a great question. I think a few things about this, actually. I think that's true to some degree, but I'll also argue against it. One of the beautiful things about indoor ag is that it's a contained picture. So you're limiting your risk to some degree on so many things. You're limiting the risk on weather. You're limiting the risk on a lot of the financial risk. You're taking some of the risk of conventional ag down, primarily weather and stability of forecast. And year-round production, right? So you can produce year-round without the weather implications. So that inherently makes it attractive. And then when you start to think about the unit economics, if you can see 30, 40, 50% margins as opposed to 4 or 5% margins, then that becomes an economically attractive picture. And so you are seeing a lot of people with non-conventional farming backgrounds getting into the indoor farming space. We were just talking about this actually earlier with a group, because two of their farms are run by former Wall Street folks who wanted to have a career transition. Their parents were in farming. They were actually one was in farming, one was in ranching. And they wanted to get back into the ag space, but they didn't want to do it in the way their parents did it. And so Indoor Ag made it a really attractive opportunity for them, because they understood what they were doing. They knew how to run a business. They understood the economics. And they had this ag background where they could actually get in and operate successfully. So we do see that a lot. We see a lot of career transitions from, you know, one space to another. We see a lot of people in the manufacturing or distribution spaces who come into space, which tends to make a little bit of sense.
More farmers is generally a good thing, but farming, whether indoor or out, is not exactly easy.
Where I'd almost say the flip side of this is, I think there's a de-emphasis on how difficult it really is to operate a farm. And that you're still dealing with all of the biological systems coupled with pasturing and distribution practices and the pricing volatility of different markets. This de-emphasis is problematic, because you're having people who risk it all by getting into an incredibly capital intensive industry without necessarily a market plan or without the understanding of the biological components. And that to me is really scary, actually, to look at the picture as a whole, if you back up and you try and understand who's getting into the space and how it can grow. So, you know, I think there's an interesting thing here, because you can have people getting into the space that aren't necessarily coming from conventional backgrounds, but I'd be wary of doing it if you don't have an understanding of how difficult it is to farm and really focus on how to take some of those growing risks away.
One of the really interesting parts of indoor farming is that there are many different business models. Some companies are selling the whole farm. Some are selling a branded product, like lettuce, microgreens, or even cannabis. And some are selling enabling technologies, like lighting or management software. With this combination of ag and tech comes a lot of complexity.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the conventional space, go to an ag conference, right? And the first thing that you're going to see is you're going to see a breakdown of grower versus grower-shipper versus packer versus, you know, there's different And every indoor facility is almost trying to do all of those things in one. You're trying to grow, package, merchandise, sell, and it's really, really hard. And it's a perishable crop, so you can't get it wrong, which is challenging. You know, you can't hold on to the crop like a commodity and wait for the best pricing. You're selling when you have it or it's gone, which is really interesting. And, you know, there's a good and bad side to this, but these are much smaller facilities. You know, you're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of acres. You're talking about, you know, a lot of times you're talking about under an acre, and then, you know, there are 100-acre farms, but these aren't the thousands and hundreds of thousands of acres of farms that we see in the Midwest and in the U.S. And so that enables them to do some of those things. But one of the interesting things I've seen is as you get smaller on the scale, you're doing more things, which is almost the opposite of what anybody who runs a business would want to do. You have a 10,000 square foot facility who's doing growing, packing, shipping, merchandising, branding, and selling. And then you have 100-acre facilities that are just selling tomato transplants to other growers who finish off and do the rest of the product packaging and whatnot. So I think it's really interesting if you look at the scale of size as well, because it seems to me, you know, qualitatively that the small farms are actually taking a lot of the responsibility of doing a full, you know, the full sort of feed through consumption, which is just interesting as a business owner.
Another big difference in indoor farming is that some of these businesses have been able to attract venture capital. But is VC actually a good fit? And if not, what are the other options?
Yeah. So I think there's a few things here too. So one, I feel like a lot of farms are going after the wrong types of capital. So I am not a believer that farms that operate and sell produce and business model should be seeking venture capital. I just think it's the wrong type of capital for these operations. These are long payback, you know, long ROI cycle projects that are much like the solar industry, much like infrastructure projects, where a debt capital or a project financing model works much better. So I think that a lot of growers, what we see is these small, you know, one-off, one-farm, 10,000 square foot facilities that are trying to raise venture capital because it's an expensive endeavor. And I think that that's problematic. And I think having a lot of press around farms getting access to this capital is also problematic because everyone thinks that they should do that. The second thing is that if you then go to the debt side and you say, okay, well, these farms should be seeking debt capital, then you have to look at what types of rates and accessibility that there is on the debt side. And for most banks, you need to have operated for 3 years in order to get access to loans, or you need to have some type of operating history. Well, the problem with indoor ag is actually the capital intensive nature of the initial build out. So now you're saying to a farmer that they have to come in with $1 million, $2 million to build a facility, and they have to front the working capital. And then by the year two or three, maybe they can start refinancing and paying back on old loans. And that is a pretty big sell for most people. And so I think that one of the interesting things in this industry is going to be the evolution of how capital sees these assets. And I would throw money at the idea that there's going to be innovation in financing models that are focused in on capital intensive upfront and higher working capital projects that have a long ROI, but are still profitable and are going to have a good return. It's just a longer term horizon. And you're going to see some of the folks that are used to investing in infrastructure projects to actually start coming into this space over the next few years.
Back when I spoke with Allison, they had just released a report on the state of indoor farming. It's linked in the show notes if you want to have a look. I asked Allison what she learned from doing this report or anything that surprised her in the results.
So one of the things that we asked growers to quantify what they thought was the most underhyped and overhyped technologies being talked about in the space right now. And the most underhyped was AI, or the thing that they were most excited about was AI and automation, or specifically in the automation side, not necessarily in the AI side. And then the thing that they thought was most overhyped was container farming and the container farming technologies. And I, you know, immediately when we were doing the analysis on and we didn't provide, by the way, we didn't provide any examples of things they could put in there. They answered that as a blank slate, and something like 80% of people answered container farming for overhyped. And so one of the things that was really interesting was, one, how many people felt aligned on that. I think when you ask open-ended questions, oftentimes you just get a full spectrum of random answers. So everyone seems to be pretty aligned on those two things. But two, you know, it sort of isn't aligned necessarily with the way that the media or investors are thinking about the space. And so you think, you know, you step back and say, hey, why is this surprising to me? And then when you think about it and you realize, oh, well, the people who are answering the survey are commercial farmers, you know, are commercial indoor operators. And so, yeah, it would make sense to me that this would be something that they would maybe feel would be overhyped because it hasn't been proven out yet. And it's not something that they would be implementing in the farm. And it's not something that they necessarily see valuable. And so, you know, maybe the broader ecosystem loves this idea, but to the farmers answering the survey, it felt out of place. And similar from automation perspective, we can talk about how much it's overhyped in the industry a lot right now, but to farmers, automation could be the difference between spending millions of dollars every year in labor and spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in labor, which could mean the difference between a 40% margin and a 20% margin.
In addition to being an entrepreneur and the leader of her company, Allison is a leader in the industry, championing topics she's passionate about and driving change in agriculture.
I wanted to kind of change directions, Allison, and ask you, recently, you actually kind of how we connected, although I knew who you were and had been hoping to chat with you for a while, was on Twitter, you posted a list of women in ag tech that you wanted to hear speaking at conferences, and that turned into a bit of a, I guess, viral movement where you ended up making a big Google Doc of women in ag tech and sort of calling out the fact that there are women innovating in this space and that they should be more well represented, especially at conferences. I just wanted to ask you what made you start doing that, and then what's been your reaction or opinion on like how this has kind of blown up? Did you expect that to happen, and what's kind of come of it from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I only did this really to go viral. I'm just kidding. It's actually the opposite. I've always been pretty quiet about these types of things. You know, I was raised in a way that was, you're not a step back, but you're always going to fight challenges. And so just, you know, fight to win, essentially. And that's how I drive a lot of my mentality around these types of things was, when we raised our first round of financing, I always give this example, back when we were raising that round, I think the average number of partner meetings that a man had to pitch in order to get a seed round of the size that we had was something around like 20, 25 people. We pitched over 80, or I pitched over 80 in order to get the same sort of size round. And that's something that, again, I didn't look at that as a disadvantage necessarily. Instead, I understood the challenge and I went into it saying, okay, I know that I'm going to have to pitch 4x the amount of people, but I'm going to do that and I'm going to do it because it's, you know, I'm going to win and I'm going to get the financing I need to carry this business through. And so that's always been the sort of attitude I've taken. And I used to avoid a lot of panels where I was asked to speak about, you know, being a woman in the tech industry or being a woman in ag. And it was funny because it all sort of culminated at this point where I speak at a lot of conferences and I'm asked to participate at a lot of events. And one of the interesting things is if you look around the room, you'd think that there were no women in ag or ag tech. And that's just not the case. I get the pleasure of working with so many women, especially on the ag research side and the big ag side, who are senior leaders of these organizations that doing real meaningful work, and on the ag tech side, who are founding companies that are doing really interesting and meaningful things. And so I kept saying, well, why isn't this happening? Why are women being asked to speak? And it's either, you know, you can look at it as a pipeline problem, or you can look at it as a networking problem, or you can look at it as a combination. But something was happening that was breaking the system for me. And frankly, I don't want to be involved in things that just don't have other people that I want to learn from. I don't want to go into a room and have the same people at the same event talking about the same things from the same perspective, because it's not worth my time or energy to do that. And same goes for me, too. If I'm asked to speak at every single event, that's the same thing. It's just that I'm not the audience member in that case, and somebody else is getting that same experience. And it's really, really invaluable. It's not valuable at all. And so I was sitting back and I had this event organized that was organized in what's coming up. They sent me an invite to sponsor the event, not speak at the event, sponsor the event. And I looked at the list and it was about 90%. The speaker list was about 90% white male. And the rest of it was either people of color, it was men, people of color. And so it was all man, 100%, not one woman on this list. And it was 30 or 40 speakers and a very, very, very limited minority of people of color. And so I just got pretty frustrated. And I was sitting there in the afternoon. And I was like, this is really annoying to me. I want to see more women. I want to go to an event with people that are, that look different and have different experiences and understand different things. And diversity is important. It's not just a buzzword. And this is annoying to me. And so I just tweeted a list of women that I know personally that I wanted, you know, that I'd love to have the opportunity to go speak, you know, listen to. And it did blow up a little bit. It was very interesting. I wasn't really expecting it, albeit I guess it is a good time to be a woman and talking about being a woman right now. So I think we had, you know, there's that going for us right now. But I think one of the interesting reactions was immediately after posting it, and we shared, so I shared 75 women, I think, and then shared a Google spreadsheet, and now it's almost 400 women because people have just been continuously adding to it, which I think is beautiful and wonderful and is exactly what should happen. And I had, and so the interesting thing to me was I had a few events that wrote into me probably within 48 hours who said, you know, I'm organizing this event. It's typically been 80% men and we want to change that and we need help, or it's been 90% men and we need help changing that. Thank you for posting this. I'm going through it now. Would you make interest to X, Y, and Z people? And that to me is like the dream, because it's really easy for somebody to put a list together, in my opinion. But, you know, it starts to show that there's this network problem. There's a problem that event organizers may not know about women being out there, or these women specifically, or any women, and maybe just don't care. And so they don't pay attention to it until somebody calls them out. And I think that's what happened. And so I think the event organizers thing has been interesting. We, one of the other things that's been really interesting is we've had two of our investors who are like, we need to do better at this and help, we need your help doing it. And I don't think it's necessarily fair to put the burden on me or any of the, like any individual in general, but it is interesting to see that they want to do something about it. So I think there's things that are starting to happen, which feels good. I don't think events are the only challenge. I think, especially on the tech side, you know, access to capital and those other challenges need to be addressed as well. But events felt like something I was doing every day, and that's why it frustrated me.
Have you gotten any like negative pushback or like reverse or people saying like, oh, this, I don't know, one pushback I could imagine is, and I've definitely felt this, like, I don't want to be asked to speak because I'm a woman. I want to be asked to speak because I'm a great speaker. And so does that, like, are there, what's your response to that? And have there been any other maybe slightly more negative or resistant pushback to this movement?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I actually think it's a total cop-out to ask any woman to be a moderator just so that you can have women involved, or to speak on a panel about diversity if they're not diversity experts. I try my hardest to say no to things that I don't feel like I'm an expert in. So, you know, I'm happy to talk about raising capital. I'm happy to talk about ag tech. I'm happy to talk about indoor ag. I'm happy to talk about building a team in New York. I'm happy to talk about many things that I'm doing and that I feel like I contribute to. Just because I'm a woman does not make me an expert in diversity. And in fact, it's something that I'm, you know, intentionally curious about and trying to navigate around myself, but it's not something that I'm an expert in. And there are plenty of people who are. So if the, you know, if the intent is to have a panel about diversity in an industry, I would always advocate to bring on experts in that topic. And frankly, it's not an ego thing. I want to be asked to speak about something I'm an expert in, because that's the thing that's going to be the most useful for the people that are listening. You don't really want me talking about hockey because I'm not a hockey expert. In terms of negative pushback, I've heard incredibly humorous things to me, but yeah, I mean, there was tons of, I would say most of the feedback was overwhelmingly positive, but there are, you know, there's a lot of people, especially in ads, who feel like, you know, most of the feedback, I guess, that's negative is around the idea that, well, if women aren't representative in the industry, then why would we ask them to be panelists type of a thing? So the overwhelming majority of farm owners in the United States are men. And so if you're doing a conference about farm ownership specifically, then, you know, most people feel, you know, a lot of the pushback is around this as an example would be something that people would say, you know, well, farm owners are men, so why would we ask women to participate? And I think that that too is a bit of, you know, that's a bit of just being naive. One, yes, majority of farm ownership is male right now, but there are women, you know, women are leading the way in terms of research and higher education, and they're coming out with advanced degrees in research in biology and plant physiology and genomics. And when you think about the tech industry as a whole in this space, you know, the people that are leading the research side are women. And when you think about the people, you know, when you think about big ag and you think about the seed companies and the nutrient companies, there are tons of women in high, you know, in leadership positions.
Allison sees two big issues preventing gender diversity: pipeline and networks.
When I think about representation in industries in general, when I think about tech CEOs or panels or employees, I want to see that be more representative of our population. And so, you know, that requires two things being fixed. It requires a pipeline issue being alleviated. So trying to reduce the challenges of access to capital for tech CEOs who maybe are women, but also maybe haven't are first-time founders or aren't in the Bay Area. There's a lot of different challenges there that make this a pipeline problem of diversity or diversity pipeline problem, and also a network problem. And this is, you know, simple things like the list. The idea was, if you don't know enough women to ask to get a gender diverse panel, then here are some you can ask. And, you know, it's not meant to be a condescending thing. It's meant to be a, you know what, if we don't have a universal list that you go to find people, here's one. If you don't know who to call to ask somebody, you know, if you don't know who to call somebody on this list and they'll help you figure out who you might be able to reach out to. And that is like the first step to me in terms of how do you break down those network barriers.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that is a great step towards it. And just like raising the awareness is the first step. And then there's lots of different paths people can take from there. And even just on the sort of vast majority of farmers are men, while definitely true, I would argue like a lot of the farmers I talk to fully state the importance of having their wives in that farming system, and whether it's running the books or otherwise, and think of it as a farming team and a farming family. And so I think it's, you know, probably misses some of the point, even that stat about the number of farmers who are men.
One of the interesting things I'll just add to that, though, is that there is this changing dynamic of who is a farmer. You know, you asked this earlier about the indoor farming space, and I answered via profession, but you're also seeing a dynamic shift of who is a farmer. We're working with over, you know, 150 some odd customer growers around the world, and I'd say probably, I think close to 40% are women-operated farms. So that's a very different number than, you know, ranching or commodities or whatever it may be. But it's an interesting picture to look at as we start to think, you know, okay, how is farming changing? And then who is a farmer, or what is the concept of a farmer is starting to shift a little bit.
Very much so. And actually I'm seeing the same thing, but on the opposite side. So we've been running at Icentic a program for farmer entrepreneurs. So producers who raised their hand and wanted to go on the startup journey because they have an idea or a burning pain point that they want to solve. And that both of the cohorts we've run so far, very small sample size, but have been much more close to sort of gender balance, sort of more of like a 40-45% female in self-selecting to be entrepreneurs coming from the producer and ag community. So starting to see that change on that side as well, which I think is really exciting and interesting.
That's very cool.
Well, Allison, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And hope to meet you in person sometime soon, maybe at a conference or otherwise.
Where we're both panelists.
That's right.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Ag Tech, So What? You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.